This podcast from the 2011 Maine Festival of the Book, an annual festival organized by Maine Reads, is brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council.
Julia Glass, the author of Three Junes, winner of the 2002 National Book Award for Fiction, The Whole World Over, I See You Everywhere, winner of the 2009 Bingham University John Gardner Book Award, and most recently, The Widower's Tale. She's received fellowships from National Endowment of the Arts, the New York Foundation of the Arts, the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. Her short fiction has won several prizes, and her personal essays have been widely anthologized, and she lives in Massachusetts with her family. Julia?
Well, thank you for coming. What an April 1st. First, I want to thank Karen for conceiving of this festival. I didn't know about that background to this one. And I particularly want to thank Sarah Cecil because I do a lot of these festivals. In fact, this winter I've already been to Tucson and to Fort Lauderdale where the weather was a little bit different than it is here. And in a couple of weeks, I'll be at Newburyport. And I always have a great time once I get to the festivals. But I have to tell you, Sarah, you are the very, very best organizer that I have met of any of these festivals. So attentive to so many logistics and details and authors' neuroses. Thank you very much. And I also want to say that I'm really thrilled to be here with Stuart. I'm a longtime fan of Stuart's novels, and there are many, and they are all wonderful. And Stuart and I tend to intersect at another sort of event, a conference in New Orleans every other year, and Sarah may tell the story about our connection there, but it was only this past November that I learned that this book, that Stuart's book, Emily Alone, is about a widow, and my book, The Widower's Tale, is about a widower. And suddenly I had fantasies of this blind date. I was very excited that my widower might have this widow to meet. Well, I got the manuscript of Stuart's book and discovered that she's about 80 and my widower is 70. And I just, you know, I'd like to think that he's very liberal-minded about that kind of thing. But temperamentally, I'm not sure either. We're going to have to discuss that. No, I'm not sure they're going to get along. But anyway, it was a thought. So I'm going to read a bit from The Widower's Tale. And it is indeed about this 70-year-old widower named Percy Darling, who lives in a very liberal, affluent rural town west of Boston that is based on my hometown of Lincoln. I think some of you may know it because some people ask me, but this fictionalized version of this town. And he's just retired from being a librarian at Widener Library at Harvard. And he has two grown daughters, one of whom is in great crisis, the other is very successful. And he makes a huge change in his very staid, routine life in order to try to help that daughter. And of course, many things happen as a result of that. Along the way, and this book, by the way, takes place over the course of a year, which I realized in reading Stuart's book is the year that follows the year during which Emily Alone takes place, which was very interesting, or preceding, well, something like that. But they're about the same time, and he's someone who is struggling a lot with how much the world is changing around him in ways that he doesn't approve of, and I think those of you who are in the second half of your life, as I have to admit I am, know that feeling when suddenly the appetite for change becomes an enormous resistance to and fear of change, and that's really where Percy is in his life. So I'm going to read a section which is about, it really gives you an idea about Percy's attitudes, which are, he's a very opinionated fellow, and reminisces a little bit about his wife, his late wife, who has been dead for about 30 years. She actually died when their two daughters were in their teens, and he resolved to raise those daughters on his own and to keep life as much the way it was for them, to stay in the house. He never remarried. So you get a little picture of who he is, where he came from, and this marriage that he still cherishes in his memory. The profession I chose, like the woman I chose, belongs to the past, except in the minds of those who truly loved it and mourn its tragic demise. Even the educational path upon which it is based has become all but unrecognizable. What was once called library science now has a trend-driven hocus-pocus name, something like informational studies. A library that is respectably up to date is no longer a temple dedicated to the guardianship of books or a sanctuary for the hallowed art of reading. No. A library is a zone of cyberkinetic values, a brain as viewed by the cold, lizardly pathologist, a numbingly gray place of systems and wiring, of knowledge-related transactions that may or may not, preferably not to many of my grandson's peers, require the use of books. A library is now far more like a bank than like a church or a museum, cause for rejoicing in the minds of the Orwellian clerks who service its needs. 10 years ago, Matlock's Public Library, a cathedral-esque Victorian structure built of red brick, its front door crowned with a stained glass window depicting the warrior scholar Athena, endured a so-called renovation. Perversely, all books were permanently removed from the vaulted central room, the tall shelves replaced by carrels containing internet access stations, and bins displaying movie DVDs. The information desk is now manned, womaned, by someone whose main job is to help you reserve time slots for the computers, or guide you through the arduous process of logging on. If you do not watch your feet as you pass through this room, you are sure to trip on the electrical cords that creep everywhere like kudzu. Once, I blamed these changes on the computers themselves. Through my decades at Widener, we classified and reclassified volumes again and again, enduring a series of achingly absurd systemic quakes, each christened with yet another acronym from MARC through OLC to Hollis. Walls were ripped open to accommodate more cabling. Throughout our reading rooms, the bitter glow of screens began to clash with lamplight. But such blame is naive, merely another form of condemning the messenger. In retrospect, I am forced to accept that an atheistic passion for the abstract nature of existence, a leaning toward the mathematical, would have led sooner or later to an anti-reverence toward all things bibliographical, a sort of baby with the bathwater ethos. It is no coincidence that the first books were religious in nature, Word of God and all that. Since I stand firmly in the God is for sissies camp, I follow the logic of this evolution with more sorrow than outrage. You will assume that my house was filled to the rafters with books. Well, yes, there were quite a lot of books throughout, underfoot and overhead, tumbling out of my haphazardly placed bookshelves, stacked beneath chairs, beside beds, even in the bottoms of a closet or two. But I was never a collector. My love of books is a love of what they contain. They hold knowledge as a pitcher holds water, as a dress contains the mystery of a woman's exquisite body. Their physicality matters. Do not speak to me of storing books as bites. But they should not inspire fetishistic devotion. I kept no preciously glass-fronted cases, did not assign a room of my house to be an officially designated library, nor did I collude with antiquarian book dealers, haunt trading fairs, or participate in any bibliographic commerce other than spending too much money at the bookseller I have always favored in Ledgely. It was and still is called the Narwhal, a play on the name of its longtime proprietor, my dear friend and one-time colleague, Norval Sorensen, who can still get me nearly any volume my heart desires and whose wife, Helena, became one of Poppy's closest friends. Why did I, a robust, red-blooded man born before World War II, become a librarian, a profession that in the mid-20th century was scorned as the refuge of timid, bookish women and a handful of homosexual, sandal-wearing fops? I loved to read, and both of my parents were teachers. Mother, English, father, history. Really, it was as simple as that. In our house in Montclair, New Jersey, there were bookshelves in every room, and every room's collection of books fell within a designated subject. All wars up to and including the Civil War occupied the living room. 20th century wars dominated the foyer and downstairs hallway. My father, a fellow of pacifist temperament, taught history through teaching wars. British fiction, my mother's first love, encircled the dining room table. There were cookbooks in the kitchen, of course, but European literature in translation crammed the breakfast nook, and up in my parents' bedroom lived biographies and memoirs. In the guest room slumbered science and the visual arts. A dozen gardening volumes held court in the downstairs bathroom. In my room, however, books toppled this way and that as I pleased. My mother wisely relinquished her control beyond my door. It was straightforward then, the path I followed. I see it as proof of a happy childhood. Take that, Dr. Freud. Philip Larkin, too. And like so many people who find their calling early, I found my spouse early as well. I met Poppy at a party in Cambridge, the year I started working as a stacks page at Widener. I had been invited to one of those cattle call cocktail gatherings at the home of the curator of rare books. There, nearly all books were housed in glittering glass-fronted shelves where keys in the locks left one assuming that to open the cases without permission might trigger an alarm. Knowing no one, I gripped my gin and tonic, too strong for me back in those innocent days, and pretended great interest in a case of leather volumes in languages I did not speak or read. "Boo," said a girl from close behind me. "You are just pretending, aren't you?" Genuinely startled, I said, "Pretending what?" "To give a hoot about those books." She peered into the case. "I mean, Chaucer? Who really enjoys Chaucer?" She was extremely pretty, the cheeky girl, and she knew it. "As it happens, I love books. And Chaucer." "Of course you love books. You're here at Rupert's, which means you're at Harvard. So of course you do." I was confused. "Well, then you're at Harvard too." She laughed. "I'm the daughter of people who used to be." "Used to be?" "Used to teach here. Now they teach in France. It's not so cruel there." "Cruel?" She laughed again. "My father says Harvard is a difficult mistress, ready to betray you at the slightest lapse in protocol or devotion. If you make it here, you can't relax, not for a minute. The peak of a mountain, he says, is always a perilous place to stand, no matter how sweeping the view." Articulate though her speech might have been, I found it irritating, but at least someone was talking to me. I took a sip of my gin and felt it sting deep in my sinuses. I sneezed. "Well," I said, "in principle, I see what you mean, but I'm very happy here." "Yes, that's because you're young. You're grateful to be here. And that's fine. That's exactly as it should be, for now. If you're smart, though, you'll see it as a stepping stone, not a destination." My eyes watered from the impact of my drink. "Who are you? And are you always this impertinent?" She did not answer my second question. She introduced herself as Penelope Goodwin. "I'll let you call me Poppy if you tell me your name." "I don't care what you let me call you, but I'm Percy," I told her. "Percy Darling." She looked at me wide-eyed for a moment, as if I'd shocked her. I braced myself for some predictably dog-eared jest about my surname. "Percy Darling," she said. "Are you from Vigil Harbor?" I'd begun to find her less attractive than strange. I glanced about to see if any of my new coworkers stood nearby, anyone to rescue me from this peculiar interrogation. "Where is that?" "Darling," she said, "is an old name in Vigil Harbor. You've never been to Vigil Harbor up near Gloucester?" "Never heard of it." She looked skeptical. "Very old, very romantic. That's where my father's family landed." "A place for seduction," my mother says. "So?" The very first lighthouse keeper was Ezekiel Darling. We're probably distant cousins. She took my drink out of my hand and set it on top of the bookcase. You're not enjoying this, the drink or the party. Come to my house for something better than Chaucer and pretzels. She started away from me but stopped when she sensed I wasn't following. Come on, cousin, I live next door. You can always change your mind and come back. I'm taking care of my parents' house. Let's go make ourselves some supper. What do you think of that? Do you even know the Smithsons? I said as we crossed our host's backyard and passed through a hedge. Did you simply barge in? I used to babysit for their kids. The kids grew up, so now I take care of their plants and their dog. They invite me to everything. They think I'm lonely. Why she had approached me in that crowd of strangers, I did not ask for months. I did not want to press my luck. When I finally did, she told me that she had been attracted first by the color of my shirt. It was such a celestial blue, I mean, like actual sky. And then by the earnest look on my face as I pretended to scrutinize those books. My heart went out to you, she said, for being so over your head. And then I found out you were a darling. And you are. We married the next year. We were 24 years old. Thank you.
Thank you, Julia. Our next speaker is Stuart Onan. 20 years ago, Stuart left a career as a structural engineer for the aerospace industry to be a writer. Since then, he has produced 12 novels, including Snow Angels, Last Night at the Lobster, Songs for the Missing, and has just released Emily Alone, the sequel to Wish You Were Here. His works of nonfiction include his best-selling Faithful to Die-Hard Boston Red Sox Fans, chronicling the historic 2004 season, which he co-authored with Maine's own Stephen King. He lives with his family in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Stuart, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen, for having me here. And thank you, Sarah, for sort of living through the nightmare that was getting me here this afternoon. U.S. Airways, which used to be based in my hometown of Pittsburgh, abandoned our city for Philadelphia. And from now on, I have to fly through Philadelphia to get anywhere. So that's a pox on them, I say. It's also a great pleasure to read here with Julie, one of my favorite writers. When I found out that she was writing a book about an old guy, and I was writing a book about an old woman, I thought, that's just kind of perfect in a way. And I'd like to see what she does versus what I do. And I think it's the height of comedy that she chose as her setting, a town that she calls Matlock. I like that very, very much. Yeah. I'm going to read a little section from good old Emily Alone here. To know what's going on, you need to know the family tree a little bit. This family, the Maxwells, first appeared in a novel of mine called Wish You Were Here about 7 years ago. And there's Emily, who is, I guess they call her the matriarch. Henry, who's been dead now for about 8 years, was her husband. And his sister is Arlene. On his deathbed in the hospital, Henry called Emily to his side and said, "Please, please, take care of Arlene." And then he called Arlene to his side and said, "Please, please, take care of Emily." And they don't like each other, and they never have. There. Emily's daughter, Margaret, had some difficulties as a child. She was overweight, and this was a point of contention between the two of them. Later, she became an alcoholic. She never finished school. And Emily feels somehow that she has failed Margaret. And Margaret always kind of reminds her of this. Her son is Kenneth. Kenneth's two children are Ella and Sam, and Margaret's two children are Sarah and Justin. I think that's all you need to know. I mean, that's a lot. I'm sorry. Sorry to be so Alice Munro on you there. What I love about Alice Munro is like one of my very, very favorite writers of all time, but invariably in a story, by the second paragraph, she's introduced like eight names, and you're like, I just can't follow. I'll just keep going. This section is called Love, Emily. She didn't want anything for Mother's Day other than her children's happiness. The arrangement Kenneth sent was nice. Emily set it on the coffee table, where Rufus sniffed the pink asters as if they might be edible. But they meant less to her than his call. She didn't have to wait for it. Like every Sunday, she'd come back from coffee hour and was plowing through the Times when the phone rang. His reliability was a gift in itself, and if this eagerness to please could make him timid and distant when he felt he'd failed, he was also like his father in that he would never purposely hurt anyone, a trait Emily, not blessed with an even temperament, respected and envied. "Happy Mother's Day, Mom." "Now it is," she thanked him for the flowers. "Not my doing. Still, they're very nice. So, what's new in New England?" "Not a lot. Everyone was doing okay. After much discussion, Sam was registering for summer semester." From there, they branched off to more general topics, giving her a chance to share how tired she was of the election and the desperate state of the world. He'd have to ask Arlene about the pirates. She was done with their shenanigans. The weather was wet, but her garden was coming along. Rufus was still hanging in there. The Millers was still for sale. As always, she felt she had no news to report, as if her life had reached a kind of stasis. "All righty," he said, "and I love you, Mom, and happy Mother's Day again," before saying goodbye. She'd turned down the stereo to talk, and when she set the phone back in its charger, the house went quiet around her. Margaret would call when she called. Emily had learned long ago there was no profit in trying to anticipate her, and dialed up the volume again and went back to the art section. She found herself fretting about Sam and then Sarah, who'd lost her job in Chicago. The worst thing in the world for Sarah would be to move back in with Margaret, for both of them. And Emily wondered if she should offer to help or whether, like so many of her overtures, it would be taken the wrong way. As a mother, she couldn't say she'd done her best with Margaret, but she'd tried beyond the point where others might have reasonably given up. Henry had, worn down by the cycle of promises that turned out to be lies, the brief clean periods between treatment and relapse, the lost jobs and credit card debt. Though she understood it perfectly, his withdrawal from their daughter was perhaps the greatest sorrow in Emily's life. Through everything, she'd always included Margaret in their plans, knowing, often, in those terrible years, that her invitations would be ignored or flatly rejected, and when accepted, the results would be disastrous. For Emily, Margaret's absence was a sadness, for the rest of the family, a relief. Kenneth, like Henry, was embarrassed by her, as were Sarah and Justin, who seemed to have taken her cautionary example to heart, feeding themselves and getting good grades so they could escape to a more orderly life. But that was the past, Margaret would insist. She'd been sober nearly 4 years now. She liked to talk about a clean slate, and in some ways, their relationship had changed. But in others, it felt like the same struggle they'd waged since Margaret turned 13. While she was more open and affectionate, showily at times, as if in her gratitude she could no longer control her emotions, Emily suspected it wasn't entirely genuine. Likewise, her constant references to making amends and surrendering to a higher power, when more than anything, Emily wanted her to take responsibility for her life, past and present. The money troubles, the parade of boyfriends, the inability to follow through on all but the most immediate plans, these were the same problems that had plagued her forever. Dismayed at the arc of her thoughts, today of all days, she folded the paper and took her cup and saucer into the kitchen for a refill. Gazing out the back door at the dripping trees as she waited for the kettle to warm, she wondered at the whole chain of continuity running back through her mother to her grandmother Benton before her and down through Margaret to Sarah. Had her mother been as unhappy with her? Because they battled just as often and hard. In her later years, she complained that Emily never visited, that they always had to visit Pittsburgh to see the grandchildren, an accusation Emily disputed bitterly, since it seemed she was always driving to Kersey. always, never. Their positions were absolute. The old house was a bungalow, and when she and Henry visited, they stayed in Emily's room, the rose-patterned wallpaper untouched since the Depression, the ceilings water-stained, and by the second day, she was ready to leave. How many times did she have to win her freedom, and wasn't it unnatural to feel this way? Because she did love her mother. It was grueling, this confusion. She wished she could express this to Margaret as if, just by being mothers and daughters, they were all caught in something larger, something ultimately not their fault. She returned to Henry's chair, arranged the afghan over her lap, and pulled the lamp closer so she could work on the puzzle, the bulb warming her. But within minutes, pushed it aside, threw off the afghan, and stood, waking Rufus. He watched her as she passed, headed upstairs, but didn't follow, and she was grateful. For what she was about to do, she needed privacy. She climbed toward the second floor deliberately, head bowed, her eyes on the risers, certain she was making a mistake. Whether she was doing penance or indulging herself, she regularly performed this rite, pawing through her hoard of treasure like a curator, knowing it would change nothing. Like Margaret with her hidden chocolate, she couldn't resist. In her room, she ceremoniously faced her dresser. It had been her mother's, salvaged from the old house and expensively refinished. The top drawer was shallow, a repository for baggage tags and travel alarms, shoehorns and passports. Her mother had kept everything, and opening it after her death, Emily had been staggered. Much of the clutter dated from Emily's girlhood. It was here that she found her birth certificate and her silver rattle and her father's wallet. Among these keepsakes, tied like a gift with a yellow ribbon, was a bundle of hand-drawn cards Emily had forgotten making. Browned at the edges, her penciled hearts and flowers and cakes and houses celebrated the unalloyed joy of the only child. Here, in all seasons, were the smiling stick figures under a smiling sun. The first time she'd leafed through them, she'd been abashed at not just her clumsy lettering, but her earnestness. "Love, Emily," they closed, over and over, abundant proof of her goodness and innocence. And yet, when she revisited them, as she did now, she felt a strange regret, as if they'd been written by someone else. Her mother hadn't saved any of her other letters, only the program from her college graduation and her wedding announcement. As if in imitation, the other packet Emily removed was fastened with a pink ribbon, Margaret's cards to her, in crayon, but graced by the same wobbly hand and free sentiments. Side by side, they seemed evidence of a mysterious bond, as if she and her mother were destined to share the same fate. "I love you," Margaret had scrawled. Emily lingered over the words, wondering if the feeling behind them still held true after all these years. Or was it just a fossil, the promise, like the child who'd written it, gone forever? This was precisely the danger of having too much time to herself. She retied the packet and returned it to its niche, closed the drawer and descended again. She sat with her half-done puzzle, listening to Bach and the rain, fending off unprofitable thoughts, waiting, though she knew better, for the phone to ring. And then, when it finally did, felt relief. "Happy Mother's Day," Margaret said. "Why, thank you, dear. Happy Mother's Day to you, too. I'm not your mother. And for that," Emily said, "you should be eternally grateful." Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart. It's wonderful to get back to the story of the printed page. Now we're going to move into the interview with Stuart and Julia by Maine Reads director, Sarah Cecil, followed by questions and answers. Sarah?
Thanks, Kara. Hi, everybody. We're glad these two made it, and as Julia and Stuart intimated, they're old pals, so I think it makes it really special to have you both here. And I wanted to talk about the your writing is very character-driven, and I'm wondering how plot comes into play with that. And also, Stuart, you tell your students, dare to be boring. And so I'm wondering, what's the dividing line between boring mundane and compelling mundane as you work on this plot character thing?
Well, dare to be boring. I want them to sort of get out there on the line of, or getting away from the sort of standard conventional fiction of setup, build up, payoff kind of thing, because it becomes sort of mechanical after a while, I think. John Gardner, the late John Gardner, in The Art of Fiction, he says, if a character is worthy of and capable of love, then the reader will follow them anywhere. And I think that's true as long as you stay close enough to what their true desires are, so that everything in the book, what you select to go in the book, always impinges somehow on their true desires. So every little sort of detail there in that section has to somehow speak to Emily and Emily's past and how Emily feels about her present situation with Margaret there.
And what about the guilt thing? I think both of you, there's a lot of guilt that goes on with the children and their whole relationship with their spouses and the death and stuff like that.
Well, you know, one thing that struck me when I was reading Emily was that, like my book, I mean, and there are a lot of differences between our books and similarities, perhaps, but I think that a lot of fiction written by our generation, you know, writers who are now, let's say, in their 40s and 50s, focuses a lot on the way we deal with the legacy of our parents. A lot of us have been in psychotherapy. I can certainly say I have, but I don't know whether Stuart has. He's too healthy to have been in psychotherapy.
Yeah.
That too, I need both. Yes. I need it from both sides. But one thing that I've written from the point of view of older characters before, a bit in the beginning of Three Junes, for those of you who know that book. Fenno MacLeod's father is the first point of view in that book. But most of that book deals with how the grown children deal with the memories of and legacies of and their differing views of their parents. And I think in both of our books there's a lot of what's going on is how our older parents, how do they see their grown children who are now completely off on their own, and you're powerless to change things, yet you still try to help. I mean, it's very poignant how Emily tries to help this daughter financially, and yet, you know, in a way, you never get any gratitude. You know, it doesn't change the fundamental problems in the relationship. And then, so the parent is asking himself, well, is it my fault? What did I do wrong? But then on the other hand, both Emily and Percy were raised in eras when people didn't examine their inner neuroses and the chain of events so much. So, like Emily, Percy has one child, a daughter, who has never really gotten any traction in life, and he's trying to help her. And one thing he discovers through the book is there's a part of him that very much wants her to be really grateful to him. But you know what? It's like no good deed goes unpunished in a way. That old cliche proves to be true. And it just struck me that we're really, in these two novels, looking a lot at how people our parents' age must be looking at us, their grown children. Of course, our parents are very proud of us because we're so successful and you know, we've done everything well, right? Well, and we always call on Mother's Day first thing.
Well, this leads into the question of what was the genesis for your two major characters? I've heard talk of something.
Well, for me, I was writing a horror novel set in old-timey sort of theme park that was based on Cedar Point over in Sandusky, Ohio. And it was going to be a framed horror novel, which it was written by an African-American writer who was intent on making the great African-American horror novel, because there was no great African-American horror novel at the time. And so this was his sort of whole goal. And it was called The Ghost Ship, and the ghost ship burned down, you know, 50 years ago, and the people in it, you know, most of them died. There were a few survivors, and the survivors who were kids then come back 50 years later when they're rededicating the new ghost ship to find... Very much like it. It was very much that sort of, you know, in the mode of Stephen King. So it was this fake author. I think his name was like Curtis something, Curtis Knight maybe, was going to use the Stephen King formula to write this book about this haunted theme park attraction that was built out of old slave ship pieces. Whatever. I completely plotted the whole thing out. I wrote 90 pages. I sort of, you know, got my agent all excited about it. And then it kind of fell flat. I wasn't real happy with it. So I thought, well, maybe this is a book about the theme park and the small town that it's in. You know, big world-class theme park and little town. So I started writing that book with a kid that works at the park and then lives in the town. And I was like, oh, that's no good. Well, maybe it's just about the town. So I started writing about the town, and then it became a book about this girl that was at like the stop and go there, or the mini mart there, right near the interstate, who disappears. And so I started writing about the sheriff walking in through the doors and finding the place empty in the middle of the night. So and that wasn't working, so I sent other people in. I sent other people into that store to find it empty in the middle of the night. And it's like, oh, this is just not working. So I sent the sheriff sort of driving around town and drove around town, found all these different people, and it wasn't working either. So at one point, a woman was driving through town in a station wagon. She was going to a lake house, which she was going to close down for the very last time. They're going to be there the very last week ever at this lake house that had been in the family for so many years because her husband had died. And the other people in the family didn't want her to get rid of it, but she couldn't afford to pay the taxes on it, so she had to get rid of it. And I started following her, the woman in the station wagon. I thought, okay, maybe that's the book. And I found her. I found all the people sort of around her. I did that week at the lake cottage, and that became the book Wish You Were Here, which is sort of the prequel to this book. So it was going to be this big, fancy, heavily plotted satire of horror novels.
Is this an April Fool's joke?
No, not at all. In fact, I think you can find the original 90 pages online somewhere under the title The Ghost Ship, with the fake author's name attached to it. I think you can find it out there.
Well, you know where I was going with that question too, right?
You got a horror novel too?
No, I wish.
About the genesis of your widows.
Boy, this is so boring. I mean, you know, although I'm going to squeal on you.
That's what I'm getting at.
First I'll tell about Percy. But, okay. You know, all my fiction, each story begins with one character who kind of comes to me like a presence. And that character is in some sort of dilemma. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a story. John Dufresne, a novelist I admire, says there's no fiction without trouble. So there's got to be some trouble. And then from that, I begin to think about that character. Where does that character live? I mean, some of this is given to me right away. Maybe I know that the character is a pastry chef, or, as in this case, that the character lives in this town, Matlock. Which, I don't know why you find this so funny, but anyway, we'll have to talk about that later.
Matlock.
It's a TV show? I'd never seen the TV show.
It's the TV show that old people love.
Oh.
That's the joke.
I'm so
right, it's Andy Griffith who's got to be, you know.
Phobic. I didn't know that.
You didn't know?
No, you know the way...
Matlock.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've heard of it now.
Percy could have lived in Murder, She Wrote for a while. I don't know. Maybe he moved from Murder, She Wrote.
Okay. Well, we'll talk later on this. So anyway... So the town was the given to me, and in this case, and then anyway, when I have this character in mind, and I know that this character is rich enough and deep enough, sort of juicy enough for me to live with for a couple of years, because unlike Stuart, I don't write a novel every 6 weeks. He's got all kinds of novels in the drawer. No, I'm teasing, but that's one thing that's very important to me. Am I really going to live happily and fruitfully with this character and really get a story of some kind out of this character, or just a great character out of this character? But then I ask myself about the family. Is this person married? Does this person have children? And obviously this person has parents. One thing that the writer Carol Shields says is that every novel is the story of the destiny of a child, and that's something that's very important to me. Where does this character come from? So In the case of Percy, he came about entirely because after 24 years of living in New York, I came to back to Massachusetts where I'd grown up, and actually I had a fellowship at Harvard for the year and decided to rent a house in my old hometown where my parents still lived, in the house that I'd mostly grown up in. My kids could be close to their grandparents. And I thought over all the years that I visited this really lovely, rural, liberal-minded town, that really hadn't changed at all, and I was very lucky that way. Well, when I moved there and became a parent and a member of the community, I found that it had changed in a lot of ways that you couldn't see on the surface. And I had this sense of real indignation, like, who asked my permission to make these changes? And I began to sort of examine my crankiness about this, because I'd find that every week I'd find something new that I didn't like about the town, and my mate would have to listen to me complain. Well, when I was a kid, you know, like, they'd completely renovated the library and they'd lopped off this architecturally incompatible wing that had been built in the 60s, but I spent my whole childhood working there. It had this beautiful picture window, and then they put on this sort of pseudo Disney Gothic thing, which of course leaks like crazy and is costing the town a lot of money, and so there. Well, so there I was one night. It was actually a night of a very, very, very big snowstorm in January of 2005. And I went out for a walk on these very snowy, unplowed roads. And I was walking through this, one of those streets where the trees are just weighed down, sort of where the trees met under the snow. And I thought, this is the town I grew up in. And then I looked and I saw a light on in a house. And I looked into the house and saw that it had something like a, you know, 1,500 foot, square foot, jet age kitchen with granite countertops and halogen lights, and I started to get all furious again. You know, that kitchen belongs in Tribeca, that's not, you know. So I stood there and I thought, geez, you know, Julie, you're 49 years old and you're already, you know, this cantankerous old person.
And who does that sound like?
Well, so the thing is, I thought, you know, and that at that moment, Percy came to me. And off, you know, when really the truth is that all of my major characters grow out of a part of myself that I usually am not entirely happy with, and I'm kind of examining that part of myself. Why am I like that? And it's almost as if I'm writing sort of cautionary tales for myself. But then I have to say that when I wrote you an email after I'd finished Emily Alone, which I just loved, and I love the character of Emily, and I was asking him questions, Stuart wrote back and he said, Emily, c'est moi.
There you go. There you go. It's got to be Flaubert. Yep. I think it's interesting that you were going back to your childhood home and then writing this kind of memory book in a way, and I was doing the same thing. I moved back to Pittsburgh after being away for 30 years, and this was kind of the result of that.
And so place is a big piece of that, too.
Place is very important to me. Yeah. I mean, I have to say that when I write, just in the mechanics of writing, and every writer has their favorite part of writing a story, I love to evoke place. I love to bring the reader into a house or a landscape or a community. Things like dialogue is harder for me. I have to work much harder at it. And certainly plot is not something I feel. Plot evolves, and then I have to kind of look at it, see if it works.
I noticed that. I was reminded of the movie director Nancy Myers with her beautiful house interiors, and some of your houses, you're just like, ooh, house envy. Your houses are so incredible, some of them. I just love places and the houses and stuff. And I just wondered if that had something to do with your painter background.
I think it really does. You know, I was a painter through my, I majored in studio art in college, and I was a painter through my 20s. I really didn't start writing fiction until my early 30s. I want to say that I had had amazing English teachers in high school, and I wrote a lot in high school, read a lot, have always read a lot. I was on the literary magazine, and I wrote for the school newspaper. But I turned my back on all that and was a painter. And so when I made the decision to really commit myself to writing, and because I also had to make a living, I gave up the painting. I actually went through a period of being very, not discouraged, but kind of depressed. Like, had I wasted that decade of my life? You know, what had I been thinking? But as it turns out, and I think I didn't realize it until Three Junes was published and people began to mention it, I wouldn't be the fiction writer I am if I hadn't spent so long looking at the world visually and really taking great pleasure in trying to capture it.
I love the idea that you couldn't make a living being a painter, so immediately the first thing you turn to make the big bucks is literary fiction.
Well.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, oh man, it's just hand over fist here, man. Just pile it up. Stop, there's too much of it. We're drowning in it. Like,
I was supporting my fiction with my word skills. I was a freelance editor and a magazine writer. So
you were a copy editor too, weren't you?
I was a copy editor, yes.
Take out that comma.
Yes.
Put it back in.
Punctuation. I also really love punctuation.
The serial comma.
I do. And I have to tell you, you know, and people won't even know. How many of you know what an N dash is as opposed to an M dash? Wow. My God, what a nerdy audience we've got. So, you know, one of the things I did that, in a way, this money helped me write Three Junes. For a while, I worked for the corporate communication department of J.P. Morgan when it was a standalone bank, and I...
Not propped up, you mean.
Yeah, not propped up by Chase. Okay. We'll talk about that later, too. I copy edited and was very intrusive in that obnoxious English teacher way on all sorts of documents, whether they were recruiting brochures or speeches or newsletters. And the thing was that unlike working on copy editing jobs for real authors, the bankers loved my work. They felt like I was saving their asses every day. But the one thing I taught them, and it's actually very important in banking, was how to use the N dash, which none of them had ever heard of, and it's very important in banking, I won't say why. So they were like, wow, this is so cool, we know about this N dash thing. And lo and behold, a few years after I'd been working for them, the Chicago Manual of Style, which is very much the sort of academic source for how to style your prose, had a new edition come out. And on the front page of the New York Times was a story about how they almost eliminated the N dash. Just did away with it. And academics from everywhere put up this big stink. But so this story, you know it's a good day when the New York Times has a story like this on the front page. But what was so great was, it was before I had email, I got like 5 phone calls from bankers that I worked for saying, did you see that story about the N dash? They saved the N dash, yay N dash.
Stuart, your books are so different. I mean, well, you've now done the sequel and you can kind of talk about that too. How does this work that you move around like that?
Well, I like to read a lot of different kinds of books. I think writing actually comes from reading. Saul Bellow always says that a writer is just a reader who is moved to emulation. And I think that's absolutely true, because I had no reason to become a writer. I never sort of dreamed of becoming a writer. I just started writing one day, because I've always been a reader. And so I like to read a lot of different kinds of books. And it sort of makes sense that I would write many different kinds of books. I can't imagine writing the same kind of book over and over and over.
And yet you did a sequel.
Yeah, I knew I had unfinished business with Emily, because when I'd found her, I thought that first book was going to be all about her. And then, in that sort of Tolstoyan mode, suddenly everybody in the family seemed interesting to me, so I said, I'm going to tell everybody's story. But I knew I had a lot more to say about Emily, and came back to her, and she was sort of still there and still had her troubles, as you say.
And Julie, you did a sequel of sorts.
Well, my second book, The Whole World Over, brought back the character Fenno MacLeod from Three Junes, but I didn't expect that to happen. And you know, this is one of the advantages of working sort of blindly forward. I mean, there's a great E.L. Doctorow quote that I'm going to butcher it, that a lot of writers will quote, that writing is like driving on a long straight highway in the dark, when all you can see is as far as the front of your headlights, and you just keep driving through the desert in the straight road. And that's what it feels like to me. So here I was writing about a new group of characters in the second novel that lived in this New York City neighborhood where I actually lived in the West Village, and that had been a very big setting in Three Junes, and I chose to put one of the characters' restaurants on exactly the same block where I had chosen to put Fenno's bookstore, because it's the book. It's the block that I fantasized about one day living on until I heard that Gwyneth Paltrow had bought a house there. And I thought, no, I'm never living on that block. But I thought, well, you know, these two guys would kind of know each other. I sort of went off in this thing, and then I And here's the beauty of being a fiction writer. You know, what you do completely in private. So you can make a total fool of yourself. You can do, you know, you could introduce a giant alligator into, you know, that climbs out of that lake.
I have.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, in Wish You Were Here. You can, because nobody
That's
sees what you're
book.
Doing. It eats Emily, or Emily makes it a pet. It eats Rufus, the dog. Rufus, by the way, I love the dog. Some of the funniest moments are the way that Emily, who lives alone, talks to her dog, Rufus. And if you have ever had conversations with your pet, you will be very amused by that. But I thought, okay, so this is a crutch. I love this character. I can't let him go. But you know what? I can go along. Nobody is looking over my shoulder to scold me, and we'll see what happens. And he stayed. And that's what happened. And now I'm working on a fifth book that brings back some very tertiary characters from Three Junes. I had to think a lot about why I was doing that, but I think I'm going with that, and it's working.
Are you building the block one sort of business?
No, actually, this doesn't even take place in New York. Oh. In fact, it takes place mostly in Vermont and New Hampshire.
So when you write about these places, are these places you spent a lot of time in?
Not necessarily. There might be places that made an enormous impression on me. Scotland and Greece in Three Junes are places that I've only spent a couple of weeks in, and a long time before I'd written the book, but they really made an impression on my heart. And I also saw later on that there are places that symbolically resonated. Scotland is a place for a story of family because it's a country whose history is very much enmeshed with family loyalty, clan loyalty. Although it's a place where families have massacred one another, where great violence has been done in the name of family loyalty. So it's very double-sided. And that Greece is a place where, at least to tourists who go there, it's very much about the past. I mean, it's about beaches, but it's about a past that's very separate from the present. Mm-hmm. And that's where, so that this widower goes there to kind of re-examine his lost life and try to go forward into his future life with his grown children. But those kind of things, I always sort of hope that I don't see those things while I'm doing it. You know, I want to be sort of stupid about what's really going on there so that later on when some reader says, well, did you mean, you know, it's amazing what readers can tell you that you didn't even know was true. But if you know too much, I mean, do you find that if you know too much, it's like the metaphors or...
I think so. I mean, my philosophy is just sort of stay close to the character, mm-hmm. you know, and try to be as close to them as possible so that the reader can be intimate with them as well. There. But I don't usually write sort of big brainy books. You know, I don't write books with themes in them.
Yes, you do. You just don't know the themes.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's it. Well, I'm glad I'm not in that class then. I'd do poorly.
You both are funny people, and I keep wondering if you have to kind of restrain your funniness as you're writing. Do you find
you need
it?
To answer that one.
Yeah, I'm not funny at all.
That's not true.
No, I think Julie's really, really funny. Like, really funny.
I think you're both funny.
But I'm not funny at all. Yeah. And actually, my collection of short stories years ago when I was at Cornell, I sent it out, rejection. It won the Drew Hines Prize, and one of the awards, one of the perks for winning the prize was you got to have dinner with the judge, who is Tobias Wolff, and with Drew Hines herself, who is the heiress to the Hines ketchup fortune, and is like this with Queen Elizabeth, and which is weird. So went to dinner with her, and you know she's got the big check in the envelope, which I'm just waiting for, and champagne and all this stuff. And as she's sort of giving me the check but not letting go of it, she sort of brings me closer and she goes, Stuart, you're a wonderful writer, but you need to be funnier. And I was like, damn it. It's hard to just suddenly be funnier.
But you know, you're not giving yourself enough credit. There are some of your work is very, very dark, I would say that. But for instance, you know, there's a lot of sadness in this book, but every so often I burst out laughing, and I think one of the things you really capture is some of the, you know, it's inadvertent comedy that takes place when members of different generations get together. There's this amazing, funny scene. There are many funny scenes like that in Wish You Were Here when you've got three generations in these close quarters of this summer cabin, but there's that dinner out at the, you know, the grandmother takes everybody out to the country club, and you can picture how the grandchildren hate having to dress up. go to the Boring Country Club. And the oldest of the grandchildren, this young woman, Sarah, is being grilled, you know, in a polite way by her grandmother about her new job in Chicago and so on. And she's also being kind of needled by her cousins. And there's just this point at which she's obviously so sick of being, and she says, "Somebody please just kill me now." And I thought, oh, it was just, I don't know, I laughed out. I thought it was perfect. I mean, you have a real ear for the way in which people of different ages speak. And that is often inadvertently very, very funny. But I wouldn't call you a comic writer. No,
and I have great respect for people that can do that sort of broad-based farce and pull it off, especially if it's sort of plotted farce. And they keep you guessing and you don't know where it's going, and they still make you laugh and make you laugh out loud. And that's an amazing talent to have. And I don't quite have that skill in my toolbox there. Well, they say, you know, dying's easy, comedy is hard. And I think that's true.
You know, I wanted to make a comment that there's so much, I mean, the book is called Emily Alone, and there is a lot of Emily Alone in the book. I mean, she's with Arlene, she's with Rufus, of course, this wonderful dog, and there's a point at which Rufus gets very ill, and I won't tell you what happens, but I got extremely emotional when Rufus got ill. But the texture of Emily's days, which is mysteriously suspenseful, not suspenseful, but it's just fascinating. I found that the more I read into the book, the more I couldn't wait to return to it, even though not a whole lot happens. Like, the purchase of a new car is probably the most earth-shaking thing that happens in this book. But you know what struck me, too, is that the book captures so beautifully just the state of being alone that I wondered how much that was informed by being a writer. Because, you know, here we are, we sit in our caves, and we write, we imagine all these people, and yet, to do what we do, we have to spend a lot of time alone. And I always tell my students, many of the things you've been told about what it takes to be a writer are myths, but this one thing is true. You'd better really like to be alone with yourself. You can also love being with people. You don't have to be a hermit. But I felt in a strange way as if I was also reading about you, the writer. Do you know what I mean? As if there was kind of a meta story there. It just came to me. I don't know. Did that occur to you at all? Or
yeah, I mean, certainly that must come through it, I think. And certainly the dialogues with the dog, you know, are almost sort of verbatim.
Does a dog sit with you while you write?
No, the dog is in the house, and I'll walk by the dog, and he'll be lying there, and I'm like, what? What are you doing? You can do that all day, really? get to work. I've been writing for so long, I've sort of just gotten used to that routine of being, you know, sort of in a room by myself, sitting in a chair. I mean, it's my one superpower, that's it. And my wife always laughs because people go, "Oh, it must be fascinating to live with a writer." And she's like, "Man, that is the most boring thing in the world." And yeah, I mean, most of my day I spend sitting there like this going. hours on end just going. Yeah, no idea. Three syllable word, long A, soft consonant, second consonant. Probably doesn't exist.
Yeah, I get that thing where people say to me, "Your children must be so proud of you."
You're like, I wrote a novel during my daughter's senior year in high school. I wrote a novel which came out that year, which is set in her high school, starring seniors. So she was not real thrilled. Set in our hometown, using the same roads, the same names of people. It's like super crazy. It was written in a kind of weird naturalistic mode, but it was a ghost story, and it was about teenagers who got killed in the car wreck. Who knows? I mean, face your fears, right? I mean, the kids are both learning how to drive. I better write a novel about kids dying in a car wreck in my town. It's like, great. Well, way to go, Dad. Although in terms of relatives, which I love, you know, relatives are great, but we could do without them. But they just took all of my author copies. You get like 20 author copies, you know, and they're all gone. They took them all. I got no copy of my own book. You know, I got like this old advanced reading copy, that's it.
But I'm really selfish. My mother, you know what happens? My mother goes to my local
bookstore.
You're
going to have to buy it, Mom. You're going to have to buy it.
No, she buys tons of them. And she actually has, the bookstore tells me this too. My bookstore, it's not mine, it's my childhood bookstore, the Concord Bookshop, reports to the Boston Globe. And I get to be on that bestseller list courtesy of my mother because she just keeps going and buying more books. And they said, you know, your mom's the one who keeps you on that bestseller list and she doesn't even know it.
Well, my mother-in-law had my favorite comment about any of my books is, It was this long book set in World War II. It was very slow. It's very stately. It's very sort of self-consciously poetic. And at one time, you know, years later, she goes, you know, I really like that book. I read about half of it. I really liked it. I read about half. It was like, I didn't ask after she read the good half, you know.
On that note, we'll open it up to Q&A from the audience, and we've got microphones that the volunteers can put in front of your face if you want it. So don't be shy. There we go.
Sure you do.
Oh, it's Priscilla. Hi, Priscilla.
I am a new writer of fiction, and I'm struggling with writing about a male character and a female character, both equally important in my book. And I just think it's so wonderful that the two of you chose the opposite gender in which to embody both yourselves and your ideas. And was that a conscious choice? I mean, obviously it's a conscious choice, but if you had anything to say about that, I'd be interested.
I actually tend to write a little more often from a male point of view than a female point of view, and I'm not entirely sure why that is, but I do know this, that when I'm writing about something that I feel comes from the core of myself, and I talked about how I was writing about this kind of premature curmudgeonliness in myself with Percy, it's easier to write about aspects of myself if I push them to arm's length in some way. If the character is of a different age, or different gender, or you know, different, I suppose, nationality. But I think, you know, I like the idea of a male, you know, the male curmudgeon, and the relationship between a father and daughters also interested me in particular. So that informed his being a man. And also, you know, as I said, these characters kind of come to me, and in a strange way, he just came to me. He was a guy. That night on the road, but I think that part of it is that is that arm's length thing where I can look at it a little, because I have to make a lot of conscious choices. I have to think, well, what would it be like? It's not like, well, what is it like to be me? But what would it be like if a gay man or a teenage girl or it had these qualities?
I completely agree. I think I probably write more from a female point of view than a male point of view in my books, and maybe for the same reason, yeah. I think. But that idea of what is it like to be you, I mean, that seems to me the fascinating idea in fiction, especially you know, what we're calling character-based fiction. How does it feel to be you? What is it really like to go through these experiences? I think, to me, as a reader, that's what I go to fiction for, to sort of get out of myself and into somebody else and find out what it's like to be them. And that's why I'm a reader, and I think that's why I'm a writer, too.
But then don't you find sometimes that in those characters you're reading along and something, suddenly it's like this mirror is flashed at you and then you see yourself. Like, as I told you, you know, when I was reading Wish You Were Here, I see pieces of myself in Emily, in Margaret, the daughter, and in Kenneth's wife, the daughter-in-law, Lisa.
Lisa. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm reading along with this family and I love reading about families. That's usually, I go, oh good, a family story. That's what I gravitate toward because it's what I write. But I was surprised to suddenly I'd stop and read a scene and think, oh my God, and I'd see myself, and I didn't expect to. I wasn't looking for myself. In fact, I wasn't very happy in some instances that I saw myself.
Well, that's the hope, is that you're going to be able to bring your life into the book that you're reading and think about your life as the characters are going through whatever they're going through, even if your situations are very different in a way. I mean, a lot of the emotions sometimes are the same.
Hi, Zach.
Oh, I guess you can hear me. I have a three-part question.
Three-part?
If we miss the first part, can we get credit for the second and third parts?
I'm really interested in what the routine of a writer is. If you have a routine waking up every day, or how you go about functioning, producing, you know, every day doing something. Second part, David Gordon Green did Snow Angels. I'd like to hear about that.
Okay.
Third part, Red Sox lost today. How do you feel about that?
Damn it. Damn it. Perfect season ruined. Well, the first part, let's talk about routine.
Well, I have a feeling mine's very different from yours because I really don't have a routine, which isn't that great. I've been sort of doing an informal poll among writers I know, and so far I'm right about this theory, that virtually all writers who write every single day, and by write I mean add text to the story, whether you're this or this.
Move forward.
Right, well, I can move forward in my head, but those people are morning people. They get up early, and they start their day by writing. So however your day goes awry, you've already done that. You know, all sorts of things can happen, but you get that writing out of the way. I am not a morning person. My juices flow in the middle of the day. They used to flow at night too, but I have kids and somehow I'm sort of brain dead. I'm only capable of watching cop shows or something after about 10. I stay up late, but...
Cop shows, really?
You know, not anymore. For a while I did.
I wouldn't think of you as a cop show person.
I know, I keep sort of hoping that I might be able to approach Dick Wolf and write, you know, a new spin-off of Law and Order, but I haven't been inspired
by Law and
by
Order, Link.
Law and Order,
Matlock.
Order in the copy department. you find a dead semicolon under a bush in Central Park or something.
murder she edited.
But yeah. The important thing to me is that at some point every day, I daydream about my characters and all the big decisions that I make about what's going to happen, or how to deepen characters really takes place when I'm driving somewhere, walking somewhere, shopping for groceries, I'm in the shower. And I make a point of, it's getting harder and harder, but I make a point of generally not having my cell phone with me, don't carry an iPod. I need to be in a place where all I can hear are the voices in my head. And then the trick is to remember all of that and then kind of download it. And then what happens is once I get to the computer, let's say that because I write on a computer, if I haven't been there working on the novel for a couple of weeks, what tends to happen is there's kind of a sprint that for every day, some point every day for a few weeks, I'll get in a couple hours. And by the way, I really can't do good work for more than about 4 hours a day. That's a lot. And also, I would say that pretty much every time I sit down to actually write, a good 3/4 of the time I spend is going to be revising what I've already written. So I go back and I go over what I've done very, very carefully. And then I may add a new scene or two.
Well, when I'm not teaching, which is often, I try to write 9 to 5. I try to get to the desk at 9 o'clock and stay there all 8 hours. But in that 8 hours, I'm shooting to get one page double space. It's one double space page, around 300 words, and that's the hope. And if I stay there, you know, I'll usually get the one page. Sometimes I get a little bit more, not much more, though, but one page a day. No, I don't. I have a laptop that the only thing it does is word process, which I end up having 10-year-old, 12-year-old laptops that have an operating system that then can't drive any printer that exists. And then I have to get a new laptop, which I'll then keep for another 10 years. It's a very sort of slow, sort of pokey process, little by little by little. But when I have another job, when I have a day job of some sort, I'll try to keep the character close to me. And I'll try to keep the manuscript with me. Like an actor will keep the script everywhere so they can just look and get back to that character and connect. I try to do that. I'll try to keep the sort of the mask of character on. If I know I'm going to a place that my character is going to end up going to, I'll put that mask of the character on and try to see that place the way that the character would see the place there, and then sort of take notes on that as it happens. And I keep notebooks. I keep just tons and tons of notebooks. to try to get closer to the character and what the character might think, what they might eat, what they, and just little sort of like detail work there that may not even make it into the book at all, but it keeps me somehow connected to the character. The second part of the question was David Gordon Green was the director who wrote and directed the movie version of Snow Angels. And I think he did a really fine job. I think he did a really, really good job. I think he got the tone of it very, very right. He's also a much funnier writer than I am, so there's some comic bits that sort of leaven the heaviness of the story. He did kind of wimp out on the ending, I thought, but I think it's a really good movie, and Sam Rockwell is just a genius of an actor. I mean, if anyone has not seen the movie Moon, with Sam Rockwell, see that movie. It's Moon by Duncan Jones, who wrote it and directed it. And Rockwell is just brilliant in it. It's a great movie, I think. I watched the movie 2, 3, 4 times, and I was worried about just seeing it at all, seeing sort of my work sort of up there on the screen. And the first time I saw it, I was like, oh man, oh no, this is not working out. This is just terrible. And you know, it's going off in all these different directions. I thought, man, where's he going to pull it together? And then, in the middle of the movie, he pulls it together, and I was like, oh, that's right. That's the structure that I came up with. It went like that. It's like, durr. And every time I see it again, I look at the lines that he uses, and I'm like, man, that's a great line. And I'm like, damn it, it's one of his lines. It's not one of my lines. It's his line.
Well, thank you for coming.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and people like you. Thanks for listening and thanks for your support.